broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Refresher Wealth. Thank you for listening. We know your time is valuable. Hopefully, you're multitasking, driving down the road, doing a workout on a treadmill. We get little pings and messages from clients and listeners around the country that use their time wisely when they're listening, because we are grateful you're here. That's all we want to say.
Yeah, maybe you're, you know, maybe you're in a recliner next to the fire.
Ooh.
You know, whatever it is. Man, so, it's freezing in Arizona right now. It's like 45 degrees. So I was thinking of a warm fire.
I was going to say the grass is always greener, because when has Matt Sorensen in Phoenix said, yeah, I'd like to be in a recliner next to a fire? I'm like, what are you talking about? You need to be on a golf course, you know, drinking a margarita, playing a round of nine holes. You live in Phoenix. All the rest of us are next to a fire somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's a dreary day here in Phoenix. But hey, the opposite of a dreary day on the Refresher Wealth podcast.
There we go. So my name is Mark Kohler. I've got my co-host Matt Sorensen here. If you're new to the show, thank you for giving us a try. We are trying to be the number one podcast for tax and legal, business, wealth, asset protection strategies, kind of all of the above in that genre. There's some great legal podcasts out there that get into maybe family law or lawsuits and contracts and some of that. And once in a while, we'll broach that. But really, we're lovers. We're not fighters. We're here to just help you make money, protect it, and talk about the issues that a normal tax advisor just doesn't, because they can't make it sexy like we can. Can I say that, Matt? Is that too bold?
Yeah, we're making tax sexy. Bringing sexy back to tax.
Speaking of which, Justin Timberlake is in. I'm on the road. I'm on the road, and JT is in concert tonight in LA, and I'm like, oh, bringing sexy back. I just would love to go. For those that don't know JT, that's a song of his. But anyway, the guy's an entertainer. I mean, he is so talented. He's a scratch golfer too. He can act, he can sing, he can dance, he can do it all.
I know, man. He's a modern day Renaissance man.
He is. Tell us about our topic today, Matt.
All right. Well, we are talking about how to dance like JT. Hey, we're talking about raising money, and we're going to have our guest, I guess the show title, Raising Money with Jameson Manring. And he's a client we've worked with and somebody down here in the Phoenix area I'm going to be interviewing kind of on location. Pretty exciting. We're going to talk about just how to raise money, some of the successful strategies he's done with crowdfunding here in Arizona, dealing with accredited investors and non-accredited investors. And a lot of times Mark and I approach it from the tax and legal standpoint and what's the SEC say and what are the rules. And so we're going to kind of talk about it from his perspective. This is a guy that's raised it from hundreds of people, raised money for real estate deals. So should be a good discussion and conversation. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah. And I think many of you out there that are doing your little one-off deals, maybe you partner with your brother or you and your partner or spouse, just kind of do a little fixer-upper or pick up a rental and maybe push the limits and get a little apartment building. And you're good at it. And some of you are just going into that genre and figuring it out and loving it and getting passionate about some real estate investing on the side. Well, all of you should be open to this conversation, because at some point you're going to get good at it and go, you know what? I want to take down $1 million property. I want to take down a 20 unit this or a commercial building. And you might have to raise some money and say, you know what? I'm going to call the lawyers. I'm going to talk to 10 of my buddies around the water cooler. Well, you just can't do that without dealing with the SEC and some, and that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, by the way. You can't just take people's money and promise them.
That's not the football conference?
Yeah, it's not a football conference.
No, I don't got to. Okay. All right.
These are the dreary days of baseball right now. So no football for a while. See, baseball's on the mind with Matt because, you know, he's down there in spring training.
Yeah, baby.
Started.
It's right around. Is it started?
Yeah. See, you don't even know what's going on. Okay. Now, anyway, yes, it has.
I'm just like, I got two full-time jobs right now, man. I don't even know what's going on. Donald Trump's still president. Has he been impeached yet? I have no idea.
Yeah. You're out of the loop. Everybody, here's the point. Matt is going on location in a real radio studio. How cool would that be? We're so ghetto. We just, once in a while, we get a real studio experience. But I think it's not that we're ghetto. We're just cheap. We're not going to pay for that type of ambiance or need. We can still make the show quality without that. But Matt's going on location here at the bottom of the hour to get the interview. So I'm not going to be a part of that interview. Or maybe I will. We're going to see if they can call me in. We're going to see. But if not, this is going to be a great opportunity for many of you to know how to do it on the ground. What do I do if I'm going to raise money for my business or my real estate deal?
Yeah.
What are some practical ways of doing it?
Yeah, love it. So now before we get into the topic, of course, we love to give you a tax and legal tip. Maybe you have no interest in raising money from other people. You're like, I've got tons of money. I don't need other people's money. Or it's just not your shtick. It's not your thing. You know, well, we got some tax and legal tips we want to dole out to you. We're here for everybody. So I'm ready for the tax tip. I think I'm on assignment for the tax tip, right, Mark?
You are. So now before we play this guitar riff and go into the tax tip, many of you that are not, you may not know this. You should follow Matt Sorensen on his Facebook. He freaking threw on a black and white camera setup, which was really retro, cool. And he pulled out his electric guitar in his office and was just jamming out. I was like, who is this guy? This is my partner. You haven't played in your band for 5 years. I thought you hung up the guitar for good, but you're still legit, huh?
Well, okay. I seriously like play my guitar like on Christmas and like, it's pretty sad. But my daughter, my youngest daughter, Addie, is, she's been doing ukulele and voice lessons. So she wanted to start playing guitar. So it kind of like inspired me. I'm like, I got to play my guitar more. And it was so much fun, man. It was just a good time. I'm terrible. I've never been great. That was okay. Now I'm really rusty, but I'm going to get it back. I spent like 30 minutes playing and I was way better after that than I was before. So it was a good time.
You know,
I was playing Run Down a Dream by Tom Petty. For those Tom Petty fans out there, rest in peace. But it's a killer song on the guitar.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, Eddie Van Halen had, you know, days he didn't feel that good. And so you look pretty good to me. I'm just saying. Okay, let's give that tax tip riff a shot.
A tax tip you can actually understand and won't put you to sleep.
A tax tip that could save you thousands.
All right. Well, my tax tip today is about an oldie but a goodie, the sale of home exemption. Right now, a lot of people are starting to get equity in their home. And one of the great tax benefits is when you own your home and live in it for 2 years out of a 5-year period, you can sell the home and avoid up to $250,000 of capital gains taxes if you're single, $500,000 if you're married. Now, that is a huge tax break, and a lot of people are starting to get their equity back in their home, or maybe you bought in the down market and you've got equity, and it may be time to move on. Maybe you're upsizing, downsizing, changing jobs, whatever. You're moving. Make sure you're looking, taking advantage of that sale of home exemption. Those limits, $250,000 to $500,000, are really generous, I think, and a lot of people on their home don't exceed those. Now, I want to make one little point on this that's just a little quirk just to be aware of. If you move out of the home and you don't sell it, but you've been there 2 years, you have 3 years to sell the home and still get the sale of home exemption. So let's maybe you're not ready to sell or whatever, or maybe you're, I don't know what the situation may be. It doesn't sell in time and you've already moved, or you're renting it for a year or two first, whatever it may be. You've got 3 years to still sell the home, and you'll get the sale of home exemption at the value of when you moved out, which is generally going to be most your gain. But just keep in mind that sale of home exemption, it's very commonly used. And we've seen, actually, I just say another part thing on this, just another spin on it. Sorry. I'm just riffing here. I'm just, you know, just like a solo right now. just going wherever the music takes me, you know? Another thing we've seen a lot of clients do over the years is they go buy a home, fix and flip rehab type thing, live in it, sell it for gain, you know, got to live in it for 2 years, go into the next home, do the same thing, and just keep taking advantage of that sell the home exemption. Now, your spouse may not be as down to that strategy as you may be, but you can use that strategy. It's not like it's just a one and done. You've done your sell of home exemption. You can't use it again. So a lot of ways to just use that sell of home exemption and avoid tax on the sell of your home.
Yeah, I love it. And I will add one other twist for those two, because it's a general principle, but there's a lot of variables.
This is Mark coming in with the drum solo now.
Yeah. Okay. It's true. I do play the drums. It's not pretty either, but someday we'll have to live close enough to each other, Matt. We can just really get the band going. Yeah. So if you move out of your primary residence and turn it into a rental, the good old days, you could just sell it within that 3-year period. And the fact it was a rental for a couple of years, no harm, no foul, you still get to exclude the entire net capital gain or up to 250 or 500. Well, the IRS came and said, no. If you convert it to a rental for the time period it was a rental, we've got to figure out how much the property appreciated, and you're going to pay tax on that piece. So if the house went up an additional $50,000 in value from an appraisal when you converted it to a rental, so you have to get two appraisals, one when you converted it to a rental, and then course, when you sell it, that acts as the appraisal. But you've got to capture that gain as investment gain. So that's kind of another little trick or nuance. So for those
But you don't lose the exemption and the gain you built up when you lived in it. That's the good news.
Yeah. And the thing is too, is if it's a rental property and then you move into it as your primary residence, you have to get an appraisal when you move into it as your primary. And then the gain that was created while it was a rental, it's got to be carved out when you go to sell it. And then any future appreciation would be primary residence. But anyway, it gets tricky. So lots of fun. If you're going down that path, talk to one of our tax lawyers and we can help guide you through it. So good stuff. All righty. Well, do I get to give a legal tip?
Yeah. Don't give an illegal tip. Just give the legal tip, please.
Okay. Let me go to that other pad of paper.
A legal tip that you can actually use.
A legal tip where you don't feel like you have to take a shower after.
All right, here is the legal. Yep, I'm on the right sheet of paper. The illegal tip, I'm keeping that in the drawer. You got to pay for those. Okay,
it's for special clients.
You know, I watch Breaking Bad. You know, Better Call Saul. I've got my Ozark list of tips for laundering money. All right, now, so. My legal tip is right down the same path of primary home ownership. I can't believe it, Matt. We are just on the same, same thought today.
Same homepage.
Same homepage. We are there.
Zing.
Zing. So on our newsletter this week and in the blog for our law firm and my personal site, you'll see an article on the DAPT, D-A-P-T. That's called the Domestic Asset Protection Trust. Now, this is a special type of trust really built for your primary home. It's just really good for that. You know, you can use it for rental property and cash and all this kind of stuff. But the basic concept is you create this trust, put assets into it, and the longer the asset is in that trust, a creditor could not touch it in any sort of lawsuit, texting and driving, bad business deal. Now, if you get divorced, your spouse will still get their share. And if you go, screw over the IRS can get their share. But other than an IRS or an ex-husband or ex-wife, that property is, and that asset in the DAPT is completely protected from a lawsuit. Now, if you notice, I emphasized the word completely because I wanted to emphasize there's no silver bullet in every possible instance. You want to be careful. DAPT laws change from state to state and this sort of thing. Now, in the article, it's lengthy. I recommend all of you get over there. You can go to kkoslawyers.com or markjkohler.com, or if you're a part of our newsletter, which please sign up if you haven't. It's free every week, a newsletter with video tips and deadlines and articles. Get over to the DAPT article and read it in depth. I list the 17 states. There's 17 states that allow for the DAPT, some states better than others, and discuss the issue of what happens if you don't live in a DAPT state? What happens if your asset is not in a DAPT state? What are your options? Does it still work and is it still helpful? And the answer is yes, it can be. There's a lot of debate around those unique scenarios, but just like Matt was talking about the sale of home exemption, it's a basic concept that can take on a life of its own with a lot of details and things like that. But Matt, I don't know, anything you want to add to on the DAP?
Yeah, I think it's good. Not everyone needs the DAP, you know, just because you own a home and you want to protect the equity, you're not going to automatically go for the DAP. We talked about some of the strategies to, protect your home from the homestead exemption and things like that. But I think, you know, if you got maybe a nice home, $500,000 of equity maybe, and other assets worth protecting, maybe that's a good time to consider the DAP. I mean, what do you think, Mark? Like, who's the right ideal person to really dig in and learn about the DAP?
Ooh, good question. I would say anybody that you're listening on this show and you have more than $500,000 of equity in your primary residence, you got to look at where you live, what your options are. Is there a homestead exemption? Are you single? Are you married? Would DAP make a good fit? Protecting your personal residence from a lawsuit. Think about it. Everybody, your home is probably one of your biggest assets in your life. And that's okay. That's for many of us. So what are you doing to protect that equity? Are you using a second mortgage, an equity strip? Are you, if you're in a state with an unlimited homestead exemption like Florida or Texas, no one can touch the equity in your home. If you're a tenancy by the entirety in the state of Hawaii, we talked about that on a show recently, and there's about 20 other states that have that rule if you're married. So there's different techniques to protect your home. I got a whole chapter of this in my book, The Tax and Legal Playbook, How to Protect Your Personal Residence. The DAP kicks in when you got about $500,000 of equity. I want to start talking. The DAP could be, and they're affordable. A couple grand, maybe $300-$400 a year to maintain. They're, you know, that if you got a, literally a $500,000 worth of equity, it costs a little bit to protect. So buck up, don't complain about the legal fees and get real. You got to do something. We live in a litigious world. Regrettable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Jaron Burgesson is the lawyer in our office that does most of the DAPs. So if you're calling in at the firm, you probably are going to get directed to him. He's turned into the resident expert within the firm on that topic.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
you ready to go on location? You going to get in your car and head over there now?
Yeah, I got to go on location. I'm trying to think of like an NPR joke to do when we're over there. Cause you know, he's got the, like the studios with the like hanging microphones and all that and the soundboard wall. And you know, so I gotta think of some NPR jokes.
Yeah, maybe. Well, if I am allowed to call in, I may be in the show with you. If not, may this, you know, force be with you. We are excited to hear from this guy. I think it's going to be good. So, okay.
All right. Packing my bags.
Buckle up. It's time to refresh you listeners. Mark and Matt have hand-selected professionals from around the world. From successful businesses, personal stories, or hard-hitting tips and tricks, please welcome today's Refresh Your Wealth guest.
All right. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome Jameson Manwaring, who is the a founder. I don't know. Are you CEO? Crap. I should pull up your bio.
Co-founder.
Co-founder. Okay. Yeah. All right. Of Neighborhood Ventures here in Phoenix. And I'm actually in studio. He's got a sweet podcast room. It looks very professional. Much more better than my laptop and microphone in my office with Mark. But thanks for having me here. I'm excited to interview you.
Yeah. Thanks for having us on the show. And we just moved into this office and we decided to do a podcast office because it's the way that we can communicate direct to people. So this is one of the first times we've used it. So
yeah, cool. Power to the people, baby. all right. Well, we're talking about raising money and our firm's worked a little bit with Jameson and I thought it'd be a really good podcast to talk about some of the practical sides of raising money from people. And what Neighborhood Ventures has done, just give you guys a quick thumbnail, is they're doing multifamily real estate in the Phoenix area. And I'll let Jameson kind of explain more, but they have a great background. His partner, other co-founders, more from the real estate side, broker side, done thousands of deals. Jameson's a former Goldman Sachs analyst, a VP of investor relations at LifeLock, and somehow got into real estate. And maybe talk about that. Why did you start going to real estate after that background and kind of finance and investment side? Why did you go into real estate?
When I was in New York, I started getting a little bit of cash to invest, and my family's all real estate people. My dad's a real estate broker. And I was so close to the stock market, and I covered software startups. Mm-hmm. So some of these really fast growing startups out of Silicon Valley. And I saw a lot about the company, got to know the management team, and then would do financial analysis. And we would rate them buy, sell, or hold. That was my role. And as I got very close to it, I decided I want to invest in other things besides these stocks. I was maybe a little too close to it. And
if you're a butcher, you might not eat the meat much.
When you are watching them every day, and you know there's great potential investing in them, but it's so much work to be a good stock picker.
Yeah.
Right. And I wanted to diversify. I wanted to get to do something a bit more stable that wasn't quite a roller coaster. And yeah. When I was living out there, my dad got a listing, and I was out at a funeral back at home in Idaho where I grew up and where my dad's at. And he said, "Hey, I got this listing. You should take a look at." It was a 10-unit property, and it had been abandoned.
Okay.
And so it was he had the listing. I was able to, I did some analysis on it. I said, well, very little chance I would lose on this.
Uh-huh.
And decided to buy it. Put in some money, renovated it, and opened it up, and it ended up doing really well for me. And I did it from New York. Mm-hmm. I found some people that were local to manage it, and I really love the process. You know, it's something that's tangible and real.
Yeah.
Immediately, once we basically opened the doors, the property did really well.
Yeah.
And I ended up selling it about a year and a half later because I had a nice return on it. And then I said, you know, this I enjoy quite a bit more than stock analysis.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it at the time, but ended up moving out to Tempe to run LifeLock's investor relations. And then we got bought out for about a year and a half after I joined the company.
Okay.
From a big cybersecurity firm out of California, Symantec. They bought us out, and it gave me the opportunity to decide what I wanted to do next. And I ended up buying a 7-unit property down in Rocky Point and moving down.
Whoa, Mexico.
Mexico. So that, I know that's probably another podcast. Yeah, for those listeners,
Rocky Point, if you live in Arizona, you know what Rocky Point is. This is, we're talking about Mexico on the beach, okay?
And I had done a lot of, you know, due diligence around owning property down there. It's a whole different podcast, but
yeah.
Went through the trust process and that whole thing. And I moved down there for the summer of 2017 and renovated this 7-unit property, but it's right on the beach. It was a really unique property, and now I run that as a, you know, kind of a bed and breakfast Airbnb.
Okay, cool.
And after doing that, I said, "This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to stay in real estate. I loved it." And I met John, my business partner. He's been in Arizona multifamily for over 25 years, and he's a partner in ABI Multifamily. He's one of the founders, and they're probably the most active broker in the Phoenix market. Mm-hmm. Sold over 100 apartments last year out of their office, and I was real interested in the capital raising side, coming from the finance world.
Well, you were investor relations too.
Yeah,
I mean, you're investor relations now, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, so,
and I thought and believe crowdfunding is just a real unique, you know, game-changing way to raise capital for anything, including commercial real estate.
Okay. Now, a lot of people have heard of crowdfunding, and there's Reg D offerings, you know, and things where you can market and solicit, but they have to be accredited investors. And crowdfunding's kind of been this niche where they don't have to be accredited. But Arizona's got a unique law. I just want to say that for those listening. It's kind of cool, I think. So someone could put up to 10 grand, even if they're not accredited. And if they are accredited, they can put in however much they want. They can put in the same offering, right?
That's right.
Yep. Okay. So that's what you guys are operating under, is you're raising money from people in Arizona on Arizona deals. And tell me why you decided to start, rather than just go out on your own, right?
Yeah.
Get financing, maybe get some angel people. Why did you want to go down this path with investors and crowdfunding? Why did you go down that path?
Yeah. You could go...
Because there's a lot of people listening that are like, you know, other real estate investors that have done deals and always think of that, right? Like raising money from others and doing bigger deals or more deals. I mean,
So John and I both wanted to do something a bit transformative. And if we failed, we were okay with that. But we wanted to do something, not just do a few deals together, but really open up investing in commercial real estate to a whole new market.
Yeah.
And if you think of the accredited investors, it's a small percent. You know, it's like 1.5% of the population.
Yeah. The 1%ers.
The 1%ers.
Damn that. I'm just kidding.
But they fund a majority of these types of private real estate projects. But you have a lot of people who make good money. They have savings. They would rather invest in something besides the stock market, and they don't want to flip homes or become a landlord. So it's a nice passive investment, and especially if the project's local and they know the area, they can drive by it. It's really we thought, I bet there's a large market of folks who would put a few thousand dollars in, you know, $5,000-$10,000 in each project, and that's outside of that accredited market. Mm-hmm. And the accredited market's great, but they can invest in a lot of things. And when you start go out to an offering to the accredited market, it's sometimes hard to.
Yeah.
They see that all the time. You know, they see a lot of opportunities. So these folks, they see. They really don't have these opportunities very often, so it's they're much more engaged audience and a kind of a right market for us.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me what you've learned as you've gone out and you've had to work with investors. Like, what words of advice do you have from someone who just starts working with investors, no matter what strategy they're doing?
Yeah.
But what have you learned of this crowdfunding process? And you guys have done two deals already, two apartment deals that have both have a couple hundred investors.
Yeah.
Like, what have you learned that you think that maybe surprised you?
The
or even maybe you expected. I don't mean to corner you into the surprised you category.
No, it was surprised a lot. You know, that people are need to understand what they're investing in. And that's the key, and that's part of why I love real estate. Is a lot of people have kind of intuitive understanding of how it works as a business. You know, rent with multifamily, it's about your rent is your top line growth. That's your income. And then you have your operating expenses. Whatever's left over is going to go to you as the owner. And so people need to understand how that works, and they also need to understand you know, the specific deal, but they don't need. They don't need to get into some of these typical details that a more sophisticated investor would want to get in, and so it does depend on if you're talking to a sophisticated investor or not. But even if you're talking to somebody who hasn't invested before, they need to understand the basics. They need to understand, you know, most of your return is going to come when we sell the property.
Yeah.
It's going to be illiquid. And,
right.
For a set amount of time, you know, you have a target hold period.
And that's a thing I think a lot of people, you know, who may not a credit investor, not invest in something like this before, they may have a stock brokerage account or IRA or 401k, and they may be used to like, I don't want to own Nike anymore. You know, I'm going to sell it and buy something else, you know?
Right.
And so they can do that in a day. Right.
Yeah.
But this is, hey, you know, you put your $5,000 in maybe, or whatever you put in, maybe even just at a minimum, you guys have $1,000 even.
Yeah.
That's locked up, right?
Yeah. And you want to think of it as your 401k at work.
Yeah.
It's going away into an investment account. You're not going to touch it. And those sorts of things on the front end to really educate them. It doesn't take a lot of sales. It's more, we believe we educate them. And then they come around and they're ready to invest.
Yeah,
you know, when they're ready. And we put a lot of emphasis on putting out good content, you know, from video standpoint or we have meetups. And then I think with investors, I learned this throughout my career, not just raising capital here, but under promise over deliver on everything. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. if you want to build a track record, you got to do what you say you're going to do, and then a little bit more. Yeah. And so we've tried to be very conservative in our assumptions, so that once you know we pay out those distributions, they're pleasantly surprised rather than the other way around.
Okay. Now with crowdfunding, you can do some marketing and solicitation, right? So you guys have a website, neighborhood.ventures. You can Google it and you find it pretty quick. So like, how did you get people? I mean, you've got a couple hundred people already invested. Like, how did you get people?
Yeah, that's the hard part. And before we launched the company, we talked to a bunch of folks who had tried and failed.
Yeah.
And some folks who were successful. And I think most folks had underestimated the amount of eyeballs you need to get to let's say you need to get 100 investors at 5,000 each, which is the average investment that we've seen so far, to raise $500,000 on a project. Mm-hmm. You know, fairly small project. But to get 100 people to do that, you need to talk to a multiple of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably 20x.
Yeah.
and so it's a lot of folks. And so we spent a lot of time reaching out to media because it's kind of a novel idea.
Yeah.
That local people could invest as little as $1,000 into a local project. So we got some good coverage early on, which really gave us a big boost. Local newspaper here did a good article on us. The News 3 and 5 did a story on us.
Okay.
And then we really knew that first project was the biggest hurdle. And we were able to fund it, but it took us 6 months to fund it.
Yeah.
To fund $500,000. And we had... You know, our Rolodex is we could have got it funded in a couple of weeks if we called some of some of the folks we knew, but we wanted to do it in the right way to we actually forced ourselves to not call those folks and to get new investors. But it was pretty painful at times because it took 6 months to raise that amount of money.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing with crowdfunding, you know, when you're going at $5,000 a piece and the max is 10. And you're even taking people at 1,000. I mean, that's a lot of hurting of people. And one of the things I tell clients who are, you know, they may have been doing real estate deals and they have partners or kind of these, you know, cash partners, so to speak. And they got small, you know, five people in an LLC maybe. And we have lots of clients in that realm. And they want to start, you know, throwing, you know, 10, 20, 30 investors in. It's like, well, you're in a different model now, you know. And one of the big distractions from that or reasons not to do it is, well, how do I deal with all these people? I mean, what's your system for communicating with these people? How do you make them feel involved? You know, where you're not having to be defensive and answering, you know, 100 questions to 100 different people all the time.
You really have to look at it once you get, you know, above 30 or 40 investors as like you're a public company. So When I was over investor relations at LifeLock, we had, you know, 40 investors, 40 institutions that owned 80% of our stock. So we really had 40 investors in your public company.
Yeah.
So we treat it the same way. We do quarterly kind of an earnings report that we email out. We do a video with it. We kind of show them the earnings just like you would a public company. We say where we did well, where we didn't do so well. We try to get ahead of any of the potential things that may be slipping or we may miss on. And then one of the unique things with what we're doing is we want our investors to stay involved throughout the process. So we do little things like surveys. Hey, we're looking at these different color of tile.
Yeah.
Here's three to pick from, pick one. And we send that out to our investor list. We get a lot of feedback from them. They love being able to be engaged in it.
Yeah.
Without having to get a phone call to go change a toilet there, but they're still involved in it to the degree that they want.
Yeah.
And
see, I love that because, and this is with me, you know, with people that self-direct their retirement account, you know, they may have a retirement account that's been in Wall Street for years and it's owned stocks and mutual funds essentially. And a lot of people just feel out of touch with it and they feel somewhat out of control. Like the money's there, but they don't understand whether it's going to do well or not, you know? And so when they put it into a real estate deal, I'm not running this deal and I don't want to, you know, but I have a much greater connection to my money now and how it's invested when I see what's going on. Like I'm seeing the actual tile going in and I'm completing a survey on what's going on, you know?
Yep.
I mean, that's huge. And, you know, I mean, how many people, they own publicly traded stock and they could call in on an earnings call. People don't do that.
No.
But they'll call in on this. They're like, oh, it's the, you know, the multifamily deal down the street, you know, or 5 miles away that I've driven by.
And we've actually got some really good insights from our investors. I mean, we're crowdsourcing information from them. We had one woman who was an interior designer her whole life and gave us some great ideas.
Yeah.
We have one guy that does countertops. Uh-huh. And so we source him.
Yeah.
So we don't look at it as, oh man, we have to deal with these investors. We look at it as they're stakeholders where we can learn from and benefit what we're doing.
Yeah. That's awesome. Cool. So you've got a system to communicate basically. You figured out good ways to get their interaction, get their input while not overwhelming yourselves with questions and what's going on. So I love that.
Well, and a key part of this is our investor platform. So they do everything online.
Yeah.
They create their account online. They upload driver's license, other documentation online. They place their investment online. The way crowdfunding works is, let's say we're raising $500,000. All the investments go into a trust account until we've reached our target that we've defined. So before we've reached that, it's basically held in that trust account. And if for some reason we don't reach our target, the money goes back to them.
Yeah.
But it's all done online. We have, built out the technology behind it. And this kind of goes to where we had to be really committed to this because you don't want to do this for one deal.
Yeah. Right?
If you're going to do one deal, you put it on a platform and, you know, some of the other platforms that are out there and they'll do the deal for you. We really want to build out our own platform. And that's what we committed to.
And that's unique to Arizona. Because like on other federal crowdfunding rules, you couldn't do that.
Right.
But in Arizona, you're not taking a fee essentially on the platform. So you can have the platform and have some control of it and then have your separate entity that owns the real estate deal that's getting the money and obviously owning the property and people getting a stake in that.
Right.
So that's a little unique just to those listening, why they can do that. Because there's other, you know, there's Real Crowd. I've been on their podcast. They've been on mine. And there's and I like those guys, but they are like, that's if you want to put your deal there.
Yeah.
Like you pay a fee, you put your deal there, and but you still got to get people there to invest, right?
And they're the platform. They do all the technology behind it. They help you get people to invest.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, some of that's on you as the sponsor as well.
Oh, yeah.
In that setting.
And there's been some that have like Realty Shares, I think, that's had some troubles.
Yeah.
In this space, I think. So I think one of the problems actually with crowdfunding is what you mentioned and what you're doing. You're doing the opposite is you have control of the site essentially and the marketing and advertising, and then they're investing in your deals and you want to make this a long-term benefit, right? These people that have invested with you, I mean, you don't want to just do one deal, right?
Yeah, so it's not a transactional thing for us in any way where, if you put your deal on the platform, you just want to get that deal done and move on. We actually had, out of our first investment, we had 104 investors. And a few months later, we posted our second opportunity and 50 of those people invested in the second one.
Yeah.
So that was a real positive thing for us because we saw what we hoped we'd see is that these people were going to be back and invest with us multiple times. And I think if you do it right, they certainly will. So, and if you think of a non-accredited investor, maybe they have a few hundred thousand dollars somewhere, you know, they're making good money and they can invest $5,000 to $10,000 a few times a year in a project and keep growing that wealth over time with you. That's our goal. And then the other important part is they can log in to the site and see how the project's going. They can see all the videos and stuff are all there, but they can see their distributions. They can see what their performance has been. And we really try to train them from the get-go. Everything, all your information's online. So, you know, go there first.
Yeah.
And so far, it's people really like that rather than having to call somebody and
So how did you build that technology? Or is there software or systems already out there that help do that? For like, because, you know, a lot of people log into their brokerage account, you know, and they can see the performance and, you know. But I think a lot of real estate investments, even in the accredited investor space, you know, they might get a statement or something every quarter, like a piece of paper. But
right.
You have a login. How did you get that technology? What do you use?
There are SaaS software as a service companies that do it.
And okay.
We leverage some of their technology and have built out some of our own.
Okay.
So the providers who do that, there are entities that do a one-time raise, and yeah. These are more non-real estate deals. But if you think of a company that wants to raise, you know, $10 million for their startup, they'll do a one-time raise. So there's technology out there that if you do want to do a one-time raise, you can use it, and the costs aren't too burdensome. But like the platform that we use, you know, it's a software that we've built on and continue to work and that's what they do, is they build platforms for crowdfunding companies like what we do.
Okay. So in that software, who's the company? Do you mind mentioning it?
Yeah.
This could proprietary information like the Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe, but
we don't say who ours are, but there's one out of Canada. It's called Catapult. There's one out of Utah, Crowd Engine.
Okay.
There's one out of
I'm just trying to help the people.
Yeah. there's a couple. There's three or four, and then there's an important company out of Las Vegas called Fund America, and they do the trust account and all the transferring of the funds.
Okay.
And we do use some of those that I mentioned, but okay. we don't say which ones.
All right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Let me go back to the marketing. So you said, because I think that's where people kind of where the rubber meets the road, right? I mean, you took 6 months to raise money on the first deal. I mean, in a real estate deal, I mean, how were you able to do that? I mean, how'd you buy time? And what's reasonable, you think, for someone raising money in this way? What kind of your timing you got to be looking for?
We actually, so the seller was a long-term client of my partner's.
Okay.
And we agreed to a six-month escrow.
Okay.
And
so you had a sweetheart deal.
Had a good deal.
You planned for this, I guess, too.
Yeah, and we made it by about 2 days.
Okay.
So it was, we took every day we could. Now the second deal, we closed in 60 days.
Okay.
And so we were able to do a normal, you know, 30-day due diligence, 60-day closing, and we had all the funds ready.
Okay.
To close.
Okay, cool. So you got some PR when you went out and raised money the first time. It's kind of some local PR, TV, newspaper. I should say newspaper. I mean, did everybody read the article online? I don't know. People read the paper anymore. But
the paper here in Arizona, there's some folks here that still like the paper in Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. So, but what did you like? I mean, how that got you attention, right? So people contacted you. How did you convert them to the sale? What was, tell me like the process of someone contacted you. What were you doing to kind of show them what the deal is? Like they go to the website, but like.
And so when you log into the website, we have all of the deal information there in a very simple way.
Okay.
You know, to somebody who's not a professional investor.
Yeah.
And we produce some really good videos so they could see the property. There's a live Q&A that's ongoing there. They could see interactive. Some of those people decide to call. They want to come and meet with us.
Yeah.
Many of them didn't and invested directly. We had a couple of meetings that a lot of folks showed up at. We had like 150 people at one of our first meeting that wanted to learn more about it. And
that's cool, because this model where you're raising money online, you're using the power of, you know, the internet and the tools and technology to distribute information, tell them how the investment's going, but you're doing local meetings, like people, and they're not flying out here. It's like neighborhood ventures. It's in their neighborhood, right?
And in Arizona, to invest through the crowdfunding, you have to be an Arizona resident.
Yeah.
So we're all about that. We're all about invest in your own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put your money out on the East Coast. Leave it here.
Okay.
And we did on the first deal, we restructured the deal a few times. And I think this is pretty insightful. The first time we went out with it, we were doing 10% common equity for everybody. And we just said, we expect it'll be about a 10% return between the cash flow and the sell.
Yeah.
And we're holding our projects for 3 years. So okay. it's not a fix and flip. It's a fix, stabilize,
yeah.
and then sell.
And hopefully I get long-term capital gain on that, yep. the investors. So that's a good tax benefit rather than yep. flipping it immediately.
Exactly. Okay. Yep. And the first time we went out with, we said, we'll just treat everybody the same. Everybody, we expect about a 10% return. And people, it didn't resonate with people. Huh. They were confused by, well, what all the risks were and all of the potential upsides. Cause we were actually modeling more like a 15% return, but yeah. we wanted to say 10 so we could achieve above that. We ended up restructuring it and doing two different offerings. We did one offering to crowdfunding folks with a 12% preferred. And then we have a separate offering, which is kind of the upside, which is for accredited investors only.
Okay.
So that's how we've structured the last two deals. The 12% preferred is capped at 12. And our projects are more like a 16 to 20% total IRR. So there's, okay. there's a good return left above that 12% if we execute well.
Yeah.
And so we learned that the hard way by having to go restructure it a few times. Once we changed the structure of it,
yeah.
it really accelerated the amount of people that got it. And we said, look, as a preferred investor, you get paid first. It's still not debt. It's
before
not
you guys make any money.
Before we get any money,
yeah.
you'll get your 12. And then if we do well, you get your 12 and we'll do well on the back end. And okay. that's our model now and going forward.
Okay. Cool. All right. What words of advice do you have for someone out there raising money from others, whether crowdfunding or not? Like, what do you think are some key things to make someone successful, or maybe even something that people screw up a lot that causes them, that hurts their deals?
Yeah, it's still it's a relationship business, right?
Yeah.
I have found myself becoming far less of a salesperson than I am just somebody who gives the best answer that I can. And I think that people appreciate that I'm not promotional.
Right? Yeah.
So if they say, what about this risk? What about this? I just explain it. I'm invested in the deal.
Yeah.
I invest in every deal and in the common equity and the upside. And I tell them that too. Right.
Yeah.
So for me to do well on this project, we're going to want to make sure to see it out. But I think you have to have a plan in place to how you're going to reach out to a large number of folks. Mm-hmm. So we had talked to about 2,000 investors from our first deal, and we ended up getting 100.
Yeah.
And when I say talk to, I mean they came to a meeting, they registered on our website, they looked at our offering, and we ended up getting 100.
Yeah.
So
it's like 5%.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And to get those 2,000, we were in front of a lot more people than 2,000 to get the 2,000 who were actually interested.
Yeah.
Now, some of those 2,000 who didn't invest on the first deal, they invested in the second deal.
Okay.
Right. And so, but having a plan in place of especially if you're going to do something where you need to get a large number of investors, you got to talk to a large number of folks, and then having the plan in place that once they invest, you're going to be in front of them with the communication, not behind them. Mm-hmm. The last thing you want is someone saying, hey, so what's going on? I haven't heard from you for a while. Right. And that hasn't happened to us because we're always in front of them. Mm-hmm. We're sending them stuff before they even ask for it.
Yeah.
And that's the cadence that we've got into.
Okay. Cause it sounds like you guys are proactive on what you're doing, upfront and straightforward about the information. These people are going to be here next month. You know, you don't just want to give them an answer that makes you feel good today, okay. Well, I think one of the long-term benefits of what you're doing, and this just kind of wrap it up here, I think, is when your projects do well and you've got this database of people that have already invested with you once, they're going to want to keep doing this. They go tell their friends, right? And you kind of get this snowball effect that it starts rolling and picking up more and more traction, and you get more and more investor appetite. Do you have an issue, or do you see a potential issue of not having enough deals to do? Like, sometimes we have clients that are like, I have more money and capital to invest than I have good deals.
No, that's something that we try to balance.
Like, what do you have going now? Do you have a deal going right now, or you have one in the works?
Well, because we've closed the last two. Closed on the last two, and we have investors messaging us every day, say, when's the next deal going to come up? And that's great, but we haven't found a deal we've liked, or we haven't executed on a deal that we've liked. We've been in negotiations with some, and we're.
But if you're an investor, you want that. You want someone to be picky in your guys' situation.
And we're very disciplined that we know we need to get this certain amount of margin or we'll just keep looking. I'd hate to be in a situation where you have to have a deal to keep investors happy because you could dilute your real investment strategy, and we're sticking to a pretty narrow strategy that we know. Mm-hmm. My partner who runs the real estate believes it inside and out, and that's what we stick with. Okay. So the good thing is in the Phoenix market there are a lot of deals in our spot. So we're small to medium sized building, 10 units to 100. Uh-huh. So we're not dealing with a lot of competition from institutional investors. We're kind of in that sweet spot. We'll go renovate them, do a really nice renovation, but we're going in the core urban areas where you see growth. And so, there's been deals that look like good deals, but they were outside of our strategy, and we passed on them because they didn't meet it.
Yeah.
Even though we probably could have made something work with it, they weren't our strategy. So we're pretty disciplined in that.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks so much, Jameson, for being on. I really appreciate it. Neighborhood.ventures, where people can go for more information, learn about what you guys are doing. Any social media places you want people to go learn more about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, our website's great. We have recently launched a YouTube channel, and each project that we do a production of a few kind of shows, inside looks is what we call them, mm-hmm. so that you can see inside the building. You can see the design plan.
Yeah.
And so you can see those on our YouTube channel. And I appreciate you having us on. It's been great.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to be back, of course, next week with another amazing episode of the Refresh Your Wealth podcast. Till then, stay calm and invest on.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.